Good evening. So tonight we'll begin the exploration of wise effort. So in the Eightfold Path, we're turning the corner from wise action into wise cultivation. So cultivation includes wise effort, mindfulness, and also concentration. Right? And the first section is that wisdom section of wise view and wise intention. So it's important to kind of just keep in mind how the Eightfold Path is really an interconnected unit. It's a series of links which are very interdependent and inter-supportive. So this wise effort, we can often see it's really connected with wise mindfulness and wise concentration. How do we actually use our practice in a way to steady our attention, to cultivate that steadiness of attention that leads to insight, leads to seeing life in a more clear, direct way. But it's also important to see it as a part of the whole, that wise effort also shows up with wise action, how we speak, how we use our bodies, how we make a living. And then wise intention, wise view are really what informs this whole process. It's really what makes it wise, instead of being just effort by itself. Now, effort is one of those terms that we all have a certain amount of baggage with. So we want to spend some time unpacking that word and how it fits into this Four Noble Truths, how it fits into the Eightfold Path. Now, from the suttas, kind of the classic definition, there's a four-part section. And we're going to take this month, do three talks. We'll kind of break that into little pieces. But the overview is wise effort is where a person generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts their intent for the sake of. Okay, so get that first part. Generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts your intent for the sake of, and then there's these four sections. The non-arising of unwholesome, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen. The abandonment of unwholesome, unskillful qualities that have arisen. The arising of wholesome, skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. And then the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, culmination of wholesome, skillful qualities that have arisen. So it's a bit of a mouthful with all these different sections here. So the first, tonight we're going to focus really on that first section, that quality of effort itself. And then in 2 weeks we'll have another talk focusing on the first two qualities and the final talk and the last two qualities. So this generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts our will. So when you hear that, we have a sense of how much effort we need to meditate. How much effort do we need to cultivate this Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths? How much energy, how much effort do we need to wake up, to be enlightened? Because remember, when it's talked about in the context of the Eightfold Path, it's really about waking up. Is that volume better if I move it in? You're shaking your head yes and no. Okay. How's that? Okay. Anybody have trouble hearing? No. Okay, good. So always remember that when it's the wise part means it's connected to liberation. It's connected to waking up. That's what this whole year is about, is seeing this foundational section of the Buddha's teachings and how each of these different links is really designed for us to deepen, to wake up. And so tonight I want to look at wise effort, and particularly the distortions around effort that we may carry into this practice from our life, from our history, from how we are in the world. So when you hear that word effort, what comes to mind? Just reflect for a moment that word effort. Some of us may like that word, some of us may struggle with it. The dictionary defines it as a vigorous or determined attempt, strenuous physical or mental exertion. It comes from two words from the old French, out and strong. So this outer strength. It's interesting, this word actually peaked in usage around the 1930s and 1940s. So in this country, of course, we're going through the Depression and going into the Second War. And all effort was just a very common word, more common than it is today. And when I hear the word effort, you know, I think about, okay, going to the gym and breaking a sweat and, you know, working hard. Maybe the effort of going through school, effort of trying to do my job, you know, the sense of toil, of work. So we often bring a lot of history to this word, effort. How do we relate to it? Maybe we like it, maybe we don't like it. So it's important to really acknowledge that. What are we bringing to the practice? Because we don't come as clean slates, do we? You know, part of it is our strengths, is what our history, the things we've developed in our lives, and part of it is also a detriment. So just notice with this word effort, this next 2 weeks, how what we bring to that and how we can start to transform that. My own history, I think when I first started to really understand or work with effort, was in high school when I was on the swim team. And for some reason, I really got into it. So I would do two practices a day, get up at 4:30, be in the water at 5 for 2 hours, and then in the afternoon, swim for another 2 hours. And just there was a lot of passion around it. There was kind of a sense of wanting to excel and strive. I wasn't a very good swimmer. I just worked really hard at it. So I had this sense of giving it my full effort all the time and exploring that edge of what was possible, what was not possible. Kind of push that boundary, working beyond my ability, beyond my exhaustion, not being stopped by pain. This is, you know, a common thing for athletes. You know, having a stoic nature was helpful because I could just kind of tough it out. But the defining feature was this intense desire for this goal, for this purpose. And looking back, you know, these 30 years, I kind of wonder what that was all about. But at the time, it was really pertinent. It had a lot of, you know, meaning for me to have a faster time and what I hoped that would mean for my life. That sense of feeling the angst as a teenager that, oh, if I got that time, then somehow that would mean I would be happy. You know, looking back, you can see that was misinformed. But that goal, you know, that created the motivation for energy, for effort. And so that effort, I think this is the reason I bring this in, is that often when we apply effort, it's we do it for a reason. We think there's something worthwhile in working this hard, in doing something with a lot of diligence, a lot of perseverance. There's something that seems to click in us. That makes sense, something that we want. It was interesting with that time in my life because I really put my heart into that practice of swimming, and I kind of failed at it. I kind of was very disappointed by the end of that practice, that, you know, how what I hoped to achieve I did not achieve. And it was hard at that time in my life, but it was also what I look back now as a wise failure. There was a wisdom in that failure itself. Because as a naive young man, I thought, oh, I could do anything I want if I just work hard enough at it. And I came up against some real limitations. Like, oh, it was a wisdom in seeing that, kind of a sobering up of that kind of magical thinking. So that kind of background, when I started to meditate in my mid-20s, I brought that same tendency for effort. That same tendency for drive. Now, my early meditation practice was really focused on this quality of relaxing with the moment's experience. That this moment's experience with my resistance to it would create suffering. That was kind of the base theme that I would work with. So I would be sitting and trying to relax physically and emotionally, mentally, with the moments arising. So you might get distracted in thought and coming back and trying to have that steadiness of attention within this relaxed quality. But it was, especially on retreats, it was amazing how much effort I would put, how hard I was working with relaxing, how hard I was working to not resist the moment's experience. So I'd be sitting, not trying to move at all, and just feeling the tension build and trying to relax with it. And it was kind of a race to see which would be first, the tension or my relaxation. And it was very difficult for a while with that set of practicing. But, you know, being stoic and being used to kind of muscling through, I felt, okay, I'm going to apply my effort in this way. Stay in my body, stay in my breath, no matter what. And then I noticed this one time I was on a retreat with Rodney down at Cloud Mountain, and I heard the bell call us back to walking. I heard the sound, and I felt, oh, there's a little moment of fear, a moment of trepidation, of dread that would arise with that sound. So in that moment of seeing that, of that arising, I realized I'm not doing something right here. Because this practice is about greater and greater freedom, greater and greater happiness. Right? So something I'm doing is wrong in that moment, is not working. See, with effort, it's so easy for it to be unwise, so easy for it to be really distorted by our conditioning, by our habits, by our history. And learning to make it wise, it does take some certain intentionality, some willingness to look closer. So in that moment of hearing that sound and feeling that fear arise at the same time, that was that wise failure that came again, to realize, okay, my muscling through it, that strategy has limitations. That way of working with effort has limitations. In fact, it's going contrary to where I want to go in the practice. So this is wise view and wise intention starting to come back in. And from what I heard from my teachers, heard from the practice and the Dharma, it's like, okay, there's something that I'm missing here. And in that moment, I saw that my intention that I was leading with had an unwise quality, had a quality that had some distortion. You know, looking back, it's, you know, similar to that. If I try really hard, if I really stay with it, then something will happen. Something will happen that I'll feel much better about myself, have a better sense of self, I'll become enlightened, and then everything will be magically better. It's a way of trying to get over my pain through forcing myself through the practice. It's a sense of failing, of realizing this strategy is a dead end, is so helpful in our practice, especially if you tend to be a little stubborn, like me. And you kind of run up against that and you realize, okay, I can't push my way through this anymore. And so instead of keep trying to do that, there's a choice to start to release that. That's where the wise intention, the wise view from understanding the Four Noble Truths, understanding really the root of our suffering, starts to come in. You know, this wise failure, some systems of practice, some traditions really emphasize the effort, the striving. And I think it's to lead to a point of almost crisis when you realize we just can't do it in this anyway anymore. And there's just a surrendering, saying, okay, I can't do this. And the whole point is to get to that point of releasing, of saying, I can't do this. And when you stop doing it, something else starts to take over the practice. That's not of your self-will. It's not of this sense of ego. The trouble with those systems is that there's often, I don't know often, but more than we'd like, casualties from that. That we try really hard to the point that our minds become unstable, you know, that sense of striving. Often in the early days of this this tradition, young men who had a lot of striving, who wanted to get enlightened this week kind of a thing, in 7 days, I'm going to just go for it and try my effort full time, they would get to the point where they got a little psychologically unstable, had some distress. And so as a tradition, as a Western Vipassana tradition, we've learned to not emphasize that striving so much. This is this interesting interplay between kind of the Western mind of inadequacy, of not being good enough, and the striving. When those come together, it's almost an explosive mix. We can almost look at wise effort as having these three components. This wrong intention, that I have to somehow get over myself. I have to make myself a better person, a better meditator through the practice. You know, looking at the sense of enlightenment as the ultimate expression of that, this idea of enlightenment. Then I put my will into that, my effort into that. I mean, so the will and effort, they work together in a way that can be very hard, very destructive. And so that's what I noticed on the retreat, that moment when I heard the bell and felt that fear, I realized this something is off in this whole system. My intention is kind of colored by that self-inadequacy, that self-lack. I'm trying to get over that by practicing diligently, practicing in a hard, strong way, even just to relax, even just to be open. You know, the instructions were beautiful, and I found those instructions to be more and more pertinent. But the way I was approaching it was so colored by my past history. When we get down to the bottom line of this, is if our effort inherently has selfing as a component, then ultimately it's going to be a wrong effort or unwise effort. So what I mean by selfing is this sense of creating ourselves, forming ourselves into a certain way, a certain stance that's reinforced through our practice. Okay, so sitting as a meditator, okay, I'm going to sit so still, I'm going to not move at all, I'm going to stay on my breath no matter what. You know, there's a sense of me being a good meditator. That's what I mean by that selfing. It can be very subtle, that sense of how I think I should be in this moment. Right? Seeing the end of that strategy, the fallacy of that strategy, I can also see how that's investing in that sense of me. So we start to release that, so then the practice becomes much more of a exploration, a sense of starting to deconstruct ourselves by not forming a sense of self around that. Now the selfing, ultimately you're going to have to have that be seen through. But often early on in the practice, and early on maybe the first, you know, 10 or 20 years, we have to apply what we have, right? We have to apply what we have. So, okay, I'm going to apply myself, connect to this breath, connect to this body. I'm going to release thinking. And there may be very much a sense of me doing that because that's what it seems to be the right thing to do. But as we do that, we're developing the skills to have steady attention, to have attention that's not distorted by our judgment. And then in that seeing that's cultivated by that, we start to see much more deeply. And it starts to unpack this whole sense of who we take ourselves to be. Now often when we're caught in wrong effort, if we look closely at that, we're often focused on states, meditative states, meditative experiences. And sure, you can practice really diligently, in a very persistent way, and certain states will arise from that practice. Now, wise effort starts to transfer the state-focused to the insight-focus. Okay, so what I mean by that is a state of mind arises based on conditions and then passes away when those conditions stop. Right, so this is something that if we just reflect for a moment, we see as a very common experience. Now, we have an argument with a loved one, there's a state of mind that comes from that. We get a compliment, and a different state of mind comes from that. You know, we see a beautiful sunset, a different state of mind comes from that. Okay, same thing with our practice. When we practice connecting with our breath, with our bodies, a state of mind arises from that. The state is not a mind. The experience of meditation is not the ultimate object of meditation. Remember the Four Noble Truths. There's not a place in there where the Buddha says, this is the state of mind that you should aim for. It's the insight, the understanding the nature of dukkha, of suffering, the origination of suffering, the cessation of that suffering, on the path leading to that cessation. It's really these fundamental insights, these insights that change our very way of seeing ourselves and the world. And to do that, the effort starts to change from us trying to achieve something to really much more release, to surrender, and deeper levels. And in that surrendering, we start to see life in a much more direct, immediate way, instead of our filter of thought, of concept, of idea. Certainly the painful ones of judgment, of prejudice, of bias, of bigotry, all these different qualities of seeing the world, but even the much more subtle qualities of just self and other. We don't forget, you don't forget how to navigate the world. We learn to connect in a much more intimate, direct way, in a spontaneous way. So when effort starts to focus on that way, it becomes more refined. It's starting to see effort that leads to that versus a state of mind. Now often when effort gets a little distorted, if we step back and just look at what the goal is, what are we trying to achieve? And often the language that we might use, the perspective we may use, the more kind of self-reference that is, the more likely our effort is going to be distorted in some way. Because whenever it's self-referencing, whenever it's focusing on that sense of self, ultimately there will be suffering at some point. Suffering will naturally arise at some point. We can almost take the Four Noble Truths and translate it as there's suffering, the origination is that selfing. When the selfing ceases, then the suffering ceases. So finding this balance is so essential. The Buddha talked about an analogy of a musical instrument. I was talking to a monk, the Venerable Sona, who was meditating, doing walking meditation, and walking so much that after doing walking meditation, and he walked until the skin on the soles of his feet were split and bleeding. Okay, so you can imagine walking so much that you're actually blistered and cut. And this train of thought arose in this monk. Okay, of the Blessed One's disciples who aroused their persistence, I am one, but my mind is not released from the effluence through lack of clinging and sustenance. So he's realizing that he's really diligent. He's applying a lot of effort, but yet he doesn't feel like his heart is waking up. He doesn't feel like he's waking up in the way that he should be. And so he's debating about maybe leaving the holy life, going back to his old life. So the Buddha shows up and says, "So what do you think, Sona? When you were a house dweller, were you skilled at playing the vina?" So the vina is a old Indian, like a lute, like a guitar instrument with strings. So he was skilled at that. "Yes, Lord. And what did you think? When the strings of your vina were too taut, was your instrument in tune and playable?" "No." "And what do you think? When the strings of your instrument were too loose, was your instrument in tune and playable?" "No." "And then when you're neither too taut or too loose, but tuned just right on pitch, was it in tune and playable?" "Yes." "So in the same way, over-aroused persistence leads to restlessness. Overly slack persistence leads to laziness. Thus you should determine the right pitch for your perseverance. Attune the pitch of your five faculties to that, and then pick up your theme." And that simple analogy of tuning the instrument so that it's perfectly in tune. It's like, how do we tune our meditation, our practice itself, so it's in tune with the Four Noble Truths? Not too slack, not too tense. So why is effort is such a paradoxical thing? It's such a quality of, sometimes it can seem like I'm applying the right amount of effort and I realize, oh, that was too much. You look externally at someone and their practice may be wise effort, it may not be wise effort. It's really you have to see internally how it's motivated. For myself, I've learned that wise effort has much more kindness to it, much more compassion. It's that willingness to shift out of a painful position and be more comfortable. Right? So I've noticed that edge, and it's actually an edge for me to actually be to shift, to break out of the posture, that is the edge of wise effort. Going opposite of where my natural tendency is. And paradoxically, as I explore that, I start to balance that sense of tension, not too slack, not too loose, became more and more embodied. So that I can practice in a still way, not moving, with comfort and ease and attentiveness. Now what happens if we're not so much on the side of being too tense, too striving, but more too, a little more lax, a little bit more easy going with our practice, maybe a little more drifty, you could say lazy or whatever that might come up. So often when that happens, the sense of purpose of practice, why we're practicing, isn't so clear. It's not so crystal clear and a passion that's present for us. It's kind of maybe a vague sense of, well, I practice because it's a good thing to do. Often when people talk about not having a daily practice and the struggles around that, I ask, well, why do you practice? And sometimes they don't quite know an answer to that. And that's connecting the dots. The clearer you're about why you practice, the easier it is to find the motivation to practice. To a point where it becomes a vital energy, it's a vital thing to see. It's important for that passion, that sense of seeing, to come internally, to not come from an external authority or external source, but to actually see for yourself really what makes the practice alive for you. When you get a hold of that, when you start to see it, and you give that some feel, it starts to grow more and more. The Buddha would talk about different reflections around this sense of bringing more energy to our practice. And one of it is mindfulness of death. He was instructing that, reflecting, do I harbor in myself any evil and unwholesome qualities which still are discarded, undiscarded, and would be a hindrance to me if I were to die tonight or during the day? And if on reflection that monk or nun realizes that those evil, unwholesome qualities are still in him, then he or she, with strong resolve, apply all his effort, vigor, and exertion, together with mindfulness and clear comprehension, for the sake of discarding them. Just as a person whose turban or hair is on fire will, to extinguish the fire, with strong resolve, apply all their effort, rigor, and exertion. So even so should that monk resolvely apply all their effort. So that sense of your hair is on fire, how much would you have to debate about that? You know, how much would you debate about that? So that sense of reconnecting with that passion, and often it needs to grow. It grows with insight. You know, we often practice on faith. We practice, okay, I'm supposed to connect with my breath, I'll connect with my breath. As we do that, we start to be able to see more and more clearly. We start to see the roots of our suffering. We just taught a beginning class last night, and it's always love to hear the beginning students, because right from the beginning, they're starting to have insights. They're starting to see that how when they connect with their thoughts and their minds, there's unrest, there's suffering. When they connect with their direct experience, there's peace. And they start to see right that from the beginning. So sometimes reflecting on that helps to build that quality of energy. So wise effort, you know, not being too tense, not being too slack. You know, finding where that edge is for us. And it's not a kind of once you figure it out, you've got it, not like riding a bike. you can always remember. You have to always be constantly surfing that edge of what is wise effort in this moment, in this expression of how I'm meeting this experience. Our past history with effort certainly comes to bear on that. It shapes how we form around that. In the next talk, we start to explore these four qualities, start to see how wise effort also has this quality of discernment, of seeing clearly what is really wholesome, what's leading to suffering, and what isn't, and how we can start to bring that effort in a more clear way. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. And as we sit, recognizing how wise effort is constantly at work, if we let it. How are you meeting this body, this mind, this heart right now? Sometimes there's a tremendous amount of effort to collect the mind, to steady the mind. Other times the effort is much more of release, of surrender. Thank you for your attention. I would just like to say a few words about the practice and reflection for this week. The homework is the old word for it. So this is heavy on the reflection section. So reflecting on what effort means to you. When you hear that word of effort, what does that actually bring up based on your past history? Reflect on how you've applied effort in your life. You know, how you've applied it, whether through sports or through work or through family, through martial arts, whatever it might be, how have you applied that effort? You know, and what was the goal? What was the intention behind that effort? The motivation for that effort and the outcome of that effort? Particularly around effort that was designed to make you a better person. And whether it's to graduate from school, to achieve a rank in a martial art, to, you know, have a family, to have that job, to get more fit, whatever it might be. Notice how those are connected, that sense of I want to be a better person and the motivation that comes up. So you're trying to get a clear survey of what we bring to this topic. Because if we don't, this is running in the background. If it's running in the background, it's controlling our actions. It's controlling the very way we perceive our practice, the very way we practice, the very way we're mindful, the very way we meet struggles and difficulty. It's almost pre-programmed. So you're just starting to reflect how it brings that effort, that sense of preconditioning, pre-assumptions to consciousness. And then start to notice how you bring this into the meditation. And during your daily practice, your formal practice, informal, start to notice the presence and quality of effort. Right? You know, how are you actually, what is the effort? Where is the energy, the application of the practice? It could be simply coming back to the breath, what you do when you get lost in thought. You know, how do you work with that sense of self that may arise? And then ask, why am I making this effort? What's the energy behind it? Right? So I hope you do this with an honest way, meaning that you just start to see that some of these back histories of effort are showing up in our practice. You know, just as a curiosity, just as an exploration. And that gives us the potential to start to free that up, to start to allow us to connect more and more with the Four Noble Truths as a deeper intention. So we'll talk about that next week in some small groups, and I'll do a kind of a recap, rehashing of this talk. So are there any comments or questions about wise effort or anything else? Yes. Yes. Yes.
So my question is, so that's just from the start, if you're honest.
Yep, thank you. Yeah, it's a great question. So just to recap for the recording, that the homework and the topic just feels like it's this really heavy ask, a heavy lift, a lot to do, and more than possible in the time we have left in our lifetime to tackle. And how to start to work with that, I think, is that kind of the essence of it? Did I miss a piece? Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yeah, good. Yeah, so there also the light at the end of the tunnel. So the way I'm holding this topic, I'm holding it as three talks. I'm holding it as an exploration. So this talk is really about seeing just what you're talking about, seeing the sense of what do we bring to that word effort. Because there's an assumption that that's the only way to be effortful. That's the only way to make progress, is I have to get in there, roll my sleeves up, and work. If I don't do that, I'm just going to be floundering. I'm going to be aimless. So this is the kind of the preconception that we're talking about. That in itself is fundamentally limiting to the practice growing. And so we have to first see that. The end of the last talk we do on the end of the month will be about effortless effort, the release of effort. So it's kind of that's kind of how I'm holding it. So in some ways, tonight's talk is designed to kind of stir you up, just like it did. It's like kind of show, okay. It's kind of the trickster teaching that you kind of stir up the pot, and you see that this is a lot of effort. I don't know if I can work with this. I mean, when I first read this list, it's like, it is heavy. Like, I have to track all these different qualities, and I have to arouse all this energy, and for myself, I tend to implode with that, right? For my own practice, it's been much more of a journey of learning to release effort, to actually learn to meet the moment's experience without any sense of effort. And so that's what I would, you know, encourage you first to just see what you're bringing to it, and I appreciate the honesty with that, but to realize that ultimately the effort is one of non-effort. It's one of surrendering to this moment's experience with absolutely nothing to do, nothing to change, nothing to achieve. All those words, achieving, doing, altering, are words of the self, words of the ego, words of ultimate of suffering. I mean, that's the whole, that's origination of suffering right there. Sometimes we can't see the sense of self so easily, but we can certainly see its footprints. We can see the marks it's made on the walls in our hearts, right? So that sense of I have to achieve, I have to do, I have to, those are all words of suffering, right? So it's, hang in there. By no means do I don't think it's helpful for the majority of people to strive and to effort. Yeah, so the word itself, we may need to find a different word. Does that help?
Yeah, a very effective word.
Yes. You're welcome. Yes.
So you said that effort in Western culture is primarily historically because of a sense of inadequacy. But what about
right. Yeah. So the question is, with Western culture, we can very, in a very generalized way, say that the sense of inadequacy tends to be what drives our behavior. It drives our effort, drives our striving, drives all this stuff. And what's the corresponding quality in Eastern culture? And that I'm not, because I've been born and raised here, so I don't know exactly. I don't know for sure from an outsider standpoint. And it's certainly, sometimes it's easy to say that, you know, if I just wasn't American, I would be happy. You know, and it's more like we have to learn our own qualities of suffering, our own qualities of how we are. And so, you know, some of us have more our roots outside of this country, and in learning how those roots still function in our hearts, in our minds. And so I'm not really sure. Well, I would, yeah, so the comment is being raised in Sri Lanka and how, you know, still there's that strong inadequacy and efforting. I might wonder if how much of the sense of colonization of the British Empire kind of distorted the natural quality of that culture and said, okay, here, take this inadequacy. It's our gift to you. You know, and so you know, and that's part of the arrogance of the colonizing powers is that, you know, our way is the best way, whether it's our religion, the way we structure time, all these assumptions. There's an inherent violence to those cultures, and that you may be a product of that. I just wonder if that's part of that. And it may be that inadequacy is part of the Sri Lankan culture too. Yeah, I don't know, so I don't want to speculate. But we do know what's, you know, in your heart, and that's whatever reason it's there, that's where the work is. And that's the bottom line. And it's a perfect path for you. We can sometimes look at our dysfunction or our struggles as something to overcome. But if you look at it the right way, it actually shows us the perfect spiritual practice for us. It's showing us exactly where we're stuck, exactly where we're identified. Because we could see all the things we've talked about so far, that sense of relationship to work and effort, the sense of inadequacy, those are some of the glue that we form around the sense of me. When push comes to shove, that's what we believe. The practice is learning to see that belief just as a thought and to see that it's ultimately empty, that it's not of substance. And in that seeing, then there's a freedom that comes from that. Your life shows you exactly where you are. Yes, Valerie.
How do you find a sense of balance when there's external pressure?
So how do you find a sense of balance when there's an external pressure, you know, from work, as we've, yeah, so that you know, those situations. You know, for myself, that sense of balance is much easier to find when I've able to find it in myself internally. What I mean by that is, if I carry the assumptions of the environment as being true internally, then it's like, you know, if you pluck a guitar and I have another guitar next to it, it starts to vibrate. you know, even the other one hasn't been plucked. And it's that sense of resonance that happens. So if deep down I realize, okay, I'm a sense, you know, I'm not adequate, I need to do more, I need to work hard, and the external environment gives that message, then I vibrate at that same level. As I start to explore that and see the limitations of that, how that's inherent in the deep qualities of suffering, that sensing of having to always do, to always be better, to always strive, when I see that that's linked to my suffering, and I see the peace and the freedom that comes from releasing that, then I don't resonate in the same way. So then it becomes more of a practice of navigation instead of resonating. It's much harder to navigate when you're resonating at the same frequency as your external environment. And then when you start to really not believe it in yourself, you can start to be more skillful with the choices you make. Maybe changing the environment, you realize, you know, I just, this isn't working out, or how to make changes so it becomes more more supportive and less stressful. You're welcome. Anyone else have any questions or comments, things that they'd like to share? Yes. 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 Nice. Nice. So rephrase or paraphrase that, the word effort tends to be connected with things which we don't really want to do, it drudgery, a job, a chore. While things which are we want to do, there's more of a quality of intention or helping that naturally comes up. So almost the word itself kind of pushes us into that work mode or that drudgery mode. Well, if we relate to it in a different way, it's light, it's easy. It's like our heart wants to do that. There's no effort in doing that. And that's a nice reflection because, you know, certainly in practice, there's times when it does feel like work, right? It does feel like, okay, I've got to, my mind is so distracted, I'm so sleepy, okay, but I'm still practicing. You know, that's where that quality of work comes in. But if that's the only mode that we're in, then, you know, it's going to be exhausting, right? And so that's why the quality of investigation, that quality of interest, that quality of seeing, okay, where am I stuck? Sometimes that can seem like heavy work and unpleasant work, but it's actually, when you follow it down and see the emptiness in it, and you see the corresponding loosening of your suffering, your loosening of the sense of identity in an oppressive way, you realize this is really interesting to see that. And then it changes from work, from effort, to one of curiosity, of interest, of intention. And I think that's ultimately the trick that we need to learn as meditators, is to find that more and more. And realistically, we start to, I remember the first days, first months and years practicing, there's a lot of effort of just coming back again and again and again. But at some point, that effort started to work on me, that I started to actually have a more stable attention. It was almost running by itself. And then the effort fell off more and more. But still the intention, the interest, became more to the forefront. Mm-hmm. So when we stop focusing on the breath just as something I'm supposed to do, and start to actually feel the breath as a very amazing expression of life, full of rich sensations, then we've dropped away from effort to that quality of effortlessness. And that's a great observation. So maybe that's a better word than effort. Yeah, interest, curiosity. And when I teach meditation, I don't hardly ever say effort. You know, I say, you know, apply your curiosity, apply a steadiness of attention, invite this quality. Because we do go effort, we exactly as you said, we go down this whole path. It's like this whole thing loads up. And yet, it's one of the full four, or the eightfold path, wise effort. So remember, it's wise effort. So that wise changes the whole quality of it. I think we apply effort all the time that's unwise. You know, so how do we bring that wiseness to it? That's the trick, the wise part. Yes. Yes.
So it requires more effort to practice. It's not the effort to do it in the meditation, it's if you need to do it.
Yes.
So I struggle with that because the reason I meditate, I want to overpower myself and make myself do things. And I deal with that. So I was struggling to figure out if being disciplined and making myself do it at regular time, is it wise effort?
Yeah. So the question is relationship between effort and discipline and that quality of getting to the cushion, especially when life is very busy and very stressed. And the question is like getting myself to the cushion, I may use a lot of effort. Is that really wise or is it unwise? And it's a great question. And it's hard to say without the context of your overall life. You know, certainly in my own time, my own experience with that, and I tend to be a fairly disciplined person, so that's part of my conditioning, part of my drive to be conditioned. But sometimes I practice and it's not the most beneficial thing at that point. If I'm sacrificing sleep, I'm sacrificing connection with my daughter, with my wife, those can all be detriments. You know? So looking at the big overall picture can be helpful to check to see if it is wise. And yet, the practice does needs to be refreshed. It needs to be cultivated and nurtured. And that's where it's such an interesting paradox. It's almost an individual question. You know, what do we bring to that? So the best I can do is, can I give some ways to look and to investigate? And often what I suggest with people when I hear these kind of questions, I ask more about their history and their attitudes. So someone who tends to always be very disciplined and always working hard, there's going to probably be more growth being more relaxed. Someone who tends to be more relaxed, there'll be more growth being a little more disciplined. What do you mean by growth? Is that it challenges that makeup of how we take the world to be. Like our internal conditioning shapes us, okay, I'm always working, I'm always striving, or I'm always, you know, taking it easy and relaxing, those have these deep conditioning roots, which are fundamental parts of how we take ourselves to be. Challenging that starts to challenge that way we take ourselves to be. That's what makes it dharmic. So you start to notice, okay, you know, I have all these things to do and I don't feel like I have time to practice. And just, you know, just sit with that for a moment. Just pause, don't go to the cushion, but just notice, okay, what's the heart really need? What's really the kindest thing for me? If I tend to be more of a stoic, more of a person who kind of pushes. Or if I tend to be the other way, what's the most kind thing? And then that starts to bring it into the alignment of the wise part. And that's actually a nice rule of thumb, is that we tend to be so oriented to what the minds think we should do, how we should be, how you should be. While the heart, the language of the heart is completely different. And learning to listen to that language of the heart and trusting that can be so helpful. You know, what is kind right now? What is wise right now? And I can see, you know, for 100 people that could look differently. For some of us, maybe go to sit on the cushion for 45 minutes. For others, might be to take a walk or go do something else. So does that help? Yeah, not an easy answer, but you know, knowing yourself and knowing your own tendency. And by knowing your tendency, you start to distrust that a little bit. Because the tendency often is kind of really colored by our conditioning, our ignorance, our suffering. And often going opposite of what feels comfortable can be very helpful. And as a meditation teacher, I am required to say it's good to practice every day. All right, anyone else? Okay, thank you for your questions. It really helps to flesh out the topic. So next week we'll have a discussion on this. So, you know, as we talked about, this may be a little gritchy to work with effort. And we want to just kind of bring that gritchiness to light to see what we bring to the topic. And then from there we'll go into more and more the ease of practice. And Barbara has some announcements.